The weakest of all political demands is, give me something to vote for.
I'm occupying Wall Street because if you're not outraged, then you're not paying attention.
Of the economy.
I care deeply about what's happening to the country.
People are losing their homes. I'm unemployed. I'm homeless.
My retirement literally embezzled.
Corporate banking behemoths rob the American people.
That ain't right, man.
Stand up and say, this is unacceptable and we're not going to take it anymore.
This country needs an enema. Well, the world needs an enema.
Hi, this is Eve Silber, and you are listening to Occupy Wall Street Radio. I'm here with Michael Primo. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've been in the news this week.
A little bit.
So, Michael Primo, you were found innocent of all charges in an arrest that stemmed from December 17th, 2011 action.
That's right.
Tell us about that day on December 17th.
Well, it's funny to think about it as 2011. I had to keep kind of reminding myself that this has been, you know, I guess close to 14 months, something
right.
like that, 15 months since it actually happened. But the event or the incident happened on that December 17th in the evening, following an action on the earlier day at Duarte Square. Following the events that happened in Duarte Square, people left the square and kind of headed out in a bunch of different directions. I think people headed south and people headed north. And I was with a group of folks that eventually headed north, up 6th Avenue and eventually kind of zigzagging throughout the village and eventually landing on 7th Avenue. And somewhere in the mid-20s, I guess, we had been kind of the scooter patrol, the NYPD scooter control had kind of sort of caught up to us. And we were marching up 7th Avenue. And as we were coming up 79th Street over 28th Street, heading north towards 29th Street, there was a group of people sort of in front of us that were telling us that we couldn't go any farther north up 7th Avenue.
They had blocked off that street?
Yeah, and it was hard to tell if they necessarily had blocked off, but there was all the police vans were there, the scooter patrol was there, there was all sorts of NYPD presence, and there was people saying, oh, we can't go farther down 7th, they're telling us to go east down 29th Street. And so we headed down 29th Street, but as we're going down 29th Street, there they were coming down west down 29th Street. NYPD were saying, oh no, we have to go back the other way. And so headed back west down 29th Street, and on the corner, as I sort of was getting towards the edge, they had us kettled. And by the time I got to that corner, they had rolled out those long orange...
These orange nettings that were made famous very early in the movement.
Very early,
this tool where they just use to define boundaries for themselves
and
reestablish laws that you didn't know. So suddenly you weren't allowed to walk any further. They take out the orange netting, and what happens next?
Yeah, so the orange netting, it looks like these long construction netting, and they sort of rolled open this orange netting. And as I got there, they're sort of corralling off the street. We call it kettling.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't proceed any further forward. They were screaming at us to head back the other way, but behind us on the sort of the east side of 29th Street, there was police yelling at us to head back the other way. So we were kind of confused, and it was kind of like a wild cat march that day. So there was a bunch on that particular corner. There was a bunch of, you know, just Sunday evening pedestrians walking down the street, and they, of course, were some of the most irate people in the crowd, screaming, "What are you doing? I'm just like just going to the movies, the theater. That were just kind of stuck in this little corral." And so there was also some confusion by the police officers. They didn't seem like they knew where they wanted to put the orange netting. And there was this deli on the corner that they kept kind of readjusting the netting. And at some point, they created this large hole in the netting at the end of the netting. So they moved it away from the building. And of course, people were like, oh, maybe we can leave. And so people started leaving. And as they were leaving, then more people started sort of like seeing that other people were leaving. And then people were just trying to rush out of this space that they had created in their sort of confusion.
There was this little mob packed into a newly defined boundary, and then there was an opening, and people were escaping that crowd.
Because there was police saying that everyone had to leave, but we were all on the sidewalk. People say you have to keep going, and so people, like, when there became an opening, when they opened up the netting, people obviously thought that here was what we were
and
doing.
Let's frame this. This is a peaceful protest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People are marching on the sidewalks. People are chanting, but no one's committing any acts of violence. Mm-hmm. The police take out this netting, creating a very hazardous situation. Right. What happened next?
So at that point, they take out this netting. And then they have, so they have us all sort of corralled on the sidewalk on the sort of north side of 29th Street. And people are just there not knowing what's happening. The police are sort of just yelling contradictory things.
Sure.
Every police officer is kind of yelling something different about something else. And then after sort of people started leaving through the net, then they decided that, oh, no, we have to keep everyone kettled. So then they charged into the crowd like linebackers.
They had their arms up, pushing this netting into the crowd, pushing the crowd back into a building, into around a corner full of more people.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
So they had this net was coming perpendicular out from the building, from the buildings on 29th Street. And as soon as more people started leaving this sort of corralled area, they just charged into the crowd with their sort of holding their, holding the net from the top of the top part of the rubber mesh kettling net and just running into the, just bashing it into the crowd. And in that process, I sort of fell to the ground. They dropped the netting as well. Like the netting kind of fell as well. And I was just on the ground, fell backwards and then quickly tried to like just protect my head and, get out from underneath, feet. Because they're just afraid of getting trampled, because as they sort of rush towards the crowd, they're also kicking and stomping and whatnot. And so I crawled out from that little scrum that was happening. And as I went to stand up, I was tackled by what felt like three or four different officers on all sides, and they tackled me to the ground and arrested me. And then I spent the next, I guess, 2 days, 3 days in the Tombs.
2 days?
At least. I mean, it was Friday and I didn't get out. Yeah, it was definitely two nights. I think I got out, I was like the last person, one of the last people to get out on Sunday night.
What were your charges already in the Tombs?
I don't remember exactly what my charges were, but I think my charges were assault. I think my charges at that time were assault on an officer. And when I finally got to the arraignment, they were asking for like $50,000 bail.
So there were already these accusations against you that you had assaulted and injured an officer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little different, wasn't it,
than
other people experienced?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was...
These are very serious charges. Yeah. The penalties would have been...
Yeah, I don't even know. It's like it's serious, a minimum year jail time. Like, it was pretty serious.
So when did the official charges come to you, and what were they?
So the official charges, I don't exactly remember, because they changed every time I went to court, almost, or it felt like every time I went to court. But they changed, I'm slightly exaggerating, they changed several times throughout the year. But when I went in that night, I just went into the, so if people were getting arrested on the sidewalk, I had no idea what I was arrested for. So I got arrested, and I'm sitting in the I guess it was Manhattan South Task Force precinct, or the Manhattan South precinct, which was the local precinct of that area. And I'm just sitting in the bullpen, just thinking I'm going to get a desk appearance ticket for like disorderly conduct. I'll be out in a couple years.
Hours.
Yeah, I'll be out in a couple hours, and you know, I had a bunch
of
things to do that weekend.
That's what normally happens. We had already experienced that routine. So what happened to you was very different.
Very different, yeah.
And in the end, what were the charges?
In the end, the charges were resisting arrest and assault on an officer, and I think there was one other charge that I don't remember what it was. And they, when I went before the judge, they were asking for like $50,000 bail.
Okay. And let's just, I want, for our listeners' sake, I want to cut to the end of the story.
Yeah.
You were acquitted of all charges when the jury got to see film that completely conflicted with what the police said had happened.
Yeah.
What they saw film of was exactly what you just described.
Mm-hmm.
What did the cop say had happened?
Well, what the cop had said, not only what the cop said when he was on the stand, but also what he had said in some of the initial complaints, were that he had identified that I was in the street and I was obstructing traffic. And then it's a little hazy in the complaint how I got from obstructing traffic to getting on the sidewalk. But this was part of what his allegation was.
Okay.
That he wasn't able to clarify when he took the stand.
They accused that you had charged a particular officer aggressively, yep, like a linebacker, that, yep, you had never touched the ground yourself.
Never.
But in fact, you had gone aggressively at an officer,
yep,
and resisted arrests. With like three or four officers trying to take you down, resulting first, they said, in a broken wrist of a sergeant, and then they changed it to sprained wrist. Did that injury present itself in the court case?
Yeah, it did. What they said is they said that I charged like a linebacker because I have a large frame, and so, mm-hmm, somehow with my large frame, which he kept using the word frame, and I was just, you know, thoroughly intrigued by my frame, right? And so he said, with my large frame, I broke through the netting with my large frame. I tackled an officer. I tackled a lieutenant, I believe. It was Lieutenant Welsh.
Lieutenant with Welsh, your large frame.
With my large frame. Lieutenant Welsh went down to the ground. I got back up. And then I tackled two more officers, I believe, was part of his allegation. I went down again. I got back up after tackling those two more officers. And then three more officers got on me and finally wrestled me to the ground in the street.
And they took this story to the stand and they told it before the judge and they submitted it as testimony. And it was footage from a journalist named John Gerberg, who at that time was working for Democracy Now, that made it perfectly obvious that you were guilty of none of those things. You are listening to Occupy Wall Street Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York. As many of our listeners know, and if you don't know, I want to let you know now, WBAI needs your help. There is a transmitter fund that if by the end of the month we don't have the money in it that we need, this station will perish. The number to call to give money to that transmitter fund is 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. You can also go to the website at WBAI.org. You press that donate button, and it'll take you right to an opportunity to donate as little as $5 or as much as thousands. There is no doubt that WBAI needs your help right now. Michael, you listen to WBAI?
I do.
Can you imagine a New York City without WBAI?
No, I think the WBAI is critically important to have a listener-supported station that tells the stories that aren't going to be aired or broadcast anywhere else and have a prime space on that dial. 99.5 is prime space.
And to be center of that dial. Listeners, if we lose that transmitter now, there's very small chance that we will get it back. WBAI is a part of a rich history of voices being heard, of progressive politics, and it's no accident that they've given the home to Occupy Wall Street Radio that you get to listen to Monday through Friday. It's the mainstream media might have you believe that this movement is something like over, but Michael and I know that this movement is not leaving. WBAI is something that depends on you. And right now, we need your help more than we've ever needed it before. Call 516-620-3602. The Winter Fund Drive is over. What's happening right now is we have a transmitter fund drive going on. And if we don't get the money we need by the end of this month, you will lose this station. Do not take this station for granted. Visit the website at WBAI.org. Give anything you can. And call 516-620-3602 and tell people, tell this community of listeners, this community of activists, this community of people who care and want to hear the truth on the radio, let them know that WBAI needs their help right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's sad but true. The number to call to give money to that transmitter fund is 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. Visit the website at WBAI.org. Give anything you can. You are listening to Occupy Wall Street Radio here on WBAI. I'm Eve Silber, and I'm talking with Michael Primo, an Occupy Wall Street activist who was just found innocent of all charges by a jury who got to see video proving that the police had lied about every accusation they had made against Michael. So, one of the more interesting elements of this story that I find is that they offered you a chance to take a plea. Mm-hmm. What would that plea have been, and what would that have meant the rest of your life?
They did offer me a plea. I think it's something like 97-95% of all cases plead out.
Right.
And so following in that vein, they offered me a plea. Originally, up until even the morning of the plea was 15 days in jail, and I plead guilty. I forget which charges. The charges kind of fluctuated each time, which charges they were offering me to plead guilty to. But then finally, when I went to the morning of the trial, I had sort of like psyched myself out to be ready to endure this process. Then they were like, okay, well, you can plead guilty to a disorderly conduct. Do you want to take that? And just at that point, I was just like, well, Whoa. Literally an hour ago, you just said that it would be 15 days in jail. So all of a sudden, their story changed yet again. And at that point, I was just so, you know, steadfast in my resolution to, like, take this to trial and beat it that I said
no. So
they
basically went from something like a felony charge down to a violation on the morning of the trial. Mm-hmm. What do you think was going on in their minds?
I have no idea. It's so hard to speculate about their mindset because it fluctuates. And there's so many, like, what you might call deputies, if you think about that mm-hmm. Bob Marley song, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's so many deputies that I don't even fully think they fully understand the sort of gravity or the complex. I mean, not that they're not smart people and intelligent people, but sometimes I just think that they're just kind of going through the motions and that there are sheriffs above them that are sort of pushing them to go in directions. So it's really hard to speculate what the hell
what they imagined, yeah. What good they thought would come of proceeding in this way. Your trial was a jury trial.
It was.
Was that the first jury trial in Occupy?
It's the first that I know of. And another journalist, Nick Pinto, was looking into it, and he couldn't find any other jury trials that were directly related to Occupy Wall Street activities.
What was the jury selection process like?
If I wasn't so nervous, I would have probably noticed a lot more details, or maybe I may have noticed a lot because I was just, my senses were so heightened. But the jury process was fascinating. It was a 6-person jury,
okay.
As opposed to a 12-person jury. It's what's called a petite jury because of the type of offenses that I was facing. The amount of jail time dictated that you have a jury of 6 people. And so they brought 20 people in to the courtroom, and the judge got to ask them sort of basic questions like, do you understand and comprehend English? This jury will be conducted in that language. Is that something you're proficient in? And then the defense and the prosecutor got to ask them questions as well, trying to figure out sort of where they stayed and where they stand. There was one woman who was when asked about, because it was a protest trial,
sure.
And when one woman was asked about her feelings about Occupy Wall Street, she was like, it was mandatory. And you know, we're like, that's interesting. What does that mean? You're like, it had to happen. You know, about, you know.
Did she make it on the jury?
She did not make it on the jury, unfortunately.
I wonder who got her off. You mentioned that you were nervous. Mm-hmm. I mean, now we're on the other side of it and we're able to kind of relax. Mm-hmm. What were you feeling during all this? I mean, obviously you were confident in your innocence. Mm-hmm. We don't even have to question that. We have the video proof.
Right.
And we have the jury decision as well. But did you, what were your lawyers telling you, and what were you feeling?
I mean, my lawyers were Megan Morris and Rebecca Heinig, and from the New York Law Collective. They were also supported by Moira and Camille, and they were great. Like, I felt so sort of cared for and so, like, everything was, like, thoroughly prepped in such a rigorous way. There was also sort of support from kind of older radical lawyers like Marty Stoller and Gideon and whatnot. And they, you know, they were just making clear that I understood every step of the process. And so I, you know, I'm, you know, fascinated by the legal system. So it was interesting just to, like, be aware of what's happening at every step of the way.
Sure.
But of course, the whole time I'm kind of like, my stomach is in knots.
When did you find this footage?
This footage the lawyers, the attorneys found it the Sunday night before the trial. They had been prepping all, sort of like the week prior, and they had seen, The footage, so this footage was shot by this man named John Gerberg.
Mm-hmm.
They saw John in someone else's footage, and they had literally, like, pieced together the whole scene from YouTube footage. And in that YouTube footage, they saw somebody else shooting, and they were like, he looked like he was at an angle that was perhaps that
ideal.
Yeah, that $1 million angle.
Without that footage, it wasn't really clear what was going on, you were on the ground.
It was less clear. I mean, it would have been a different case. There was footage from multiple angles that kind of showed pieces of it, but this showed an uninterrupted, undisputable, like, you know,
he's
evidence.
Up on high, kind of shooting down.
Yeah, he's a tall guy.
And then
guy
he gets a little
with.
Brutalized yeah. by a female officer in that clip as well. Were you injured during that arrest?
I was banged up pretty bad. I mean, I was sort of fell down. I was sort of crawling, and then I was slammed down on the ground. So like my front of my body was all bruised up, and my knees were all bruised up. And
you spent days in
jail.
Yeah,
I spent days in cold, the tombs, which are also freezing. So I was just all kind of like discombobulated when I got out.
So what happens next? I think there's a civil case that you're moving forward with.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, these officers lied on the stand.
Mm-hmm.
And it also seemed as if the DA had something like a malicious prosecution against you. Let's say the names of these officers who lied on the stand.
The one in particular case is Sergeant Richard Jones.
Sergeant Richard Jones is mentioned as an informant in statements given by the arresting officer, Ron Vincent.
Yeah.
Which one of them claimed that you broke his wrist first?
Sergeant Richard Jones.
Okay.
He's part of the Manhattan South Task Force.
And he would have been wearing a white shirt that night.
I'm not sure. I'm not. Yeah, because he's a sergeant, you'd think he would be. But I never remember seeing him that night at all.
Is he even included in the shot of the policeman taking you down? Is he one of those?
I'm not sure. It's hard to identify who they are. Even so, it's unclear if he's actually in the shot. Basically, when they arrested me, they handed it off to Ron Vincent. Ron Vincent is just an officer, a lower ranking officer who they hand off. So the way that these protest police work is that the Manhattan South Task Force, there are, I don't know how many task force there are around the city, but there are all of these units that are kind of roving special units, and they police parades, events,
yeah,
protests.
There's something special in New York pretty much every day.
Every day there's
and
some
Occupy
kind of...
And Occupy got added to the list.
Exactly, yeah. And so Richard Jones is part of that unit, and the way they work often is they will be kind of support the local precinct there, and they'll perform the arrest, and then often they hand it off to, you know, a lower ranking
yeah.
officer who has to then deal with all the paperwork. So Ron Vincent wasn't even kind of part of the picture. He was just the person who had to fill out the paperwork.
But he did take the stand in this?
He did not.
He did
not have to test a lie. The only people that took the stand were Richard Jones and a doctor who testified Richard Jones's injuries that he sustained.
What was that?
He supposedly spent 2 months out on workers' comp for what's called a boxer's fracture,
okay.
which is a bruise.
Mm.
And so he got a little boo-boo on his thumb, which, you know, they call it a boxer's fracture because it refers to kind of the pressure. If you ball your hand into a fist and apply pressure to it, it can cause a sort of bruising in your lower wrist, like where your thumb is. You know?
Yeah, well, that's what happens
right.
when you commit acts of violence
right.
in public places.
Right. But what's interesting about it, the other officer who is sort of part of this story but has not never appeared in the actual case is someone named, I believe his name is Detective Bosco.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to talk. So there's this issue of the Taru footage,
right.
and we're dealing with this also in the March 17th event, the six-month anniversary, and that we are hounded by Taru, and there's all sorts of question as to whether that's the right application
mm-hmm.
of the Taru unit. Taru stands for Technical
Assistance
something.
Response Unit.
Basically,
I think, yeah.
they're the cops with the cameras.
Yes, yeah, and I think they also do, like, computer, like, if you're a police officer and you need, like, technical assistance
technical.
With a crime, you want someone to look at a computer, you give it to these
but
guys.
But the thing is that in this day, they claim there were no officers taking footage of the events. That footage would have revealed the lies that they were telling. But instead, our cameras captured Officer Bosco taking very good, what would have been good footage of your arrest. And this Officer Bosco at first was described as being at an undisclosed location on some kind of secret mission. And then eventually he did testify.
He never actually testified.
He made a statement.
We tried to compel the discovery. We tried to get this video footage from the NYPD for literally a year.
You were asking for tarot footage, and they just kept saying, we didn't take any.
We don't have it. We don't know where it is, blah, blah, blah. Finally, in January, they gave us some footage that wasn't even, like, really relevant to, like, what actually the incident at hand. But in this YouTube footage that we found, as well as in John Gerberg's footage, there's clearly Detective Bosco. You can see his name on his nameplate holding a camera at a 90-degree angle with the viewfinder open in front of his eyes, clearly doing what clearly looks like footage.
But he testified that he was not filming at that moment.
Exactly.
He was framing the shot.
And he testified, he went on record in another case saying that he didn't film the entire day.
So there was a lot that they had to hide that day. I just want to follow up. Nick Pinto of The Village Voice wrote a second article about this case because so many people said, well, of course we're going to sue for perjury on the officer's part, malicious prosecution on the DA's part. We're going forward with this, but the odds are not in our favor on this matter. And this is something Occupy is serving in a function, right? Bringing to light what disadvantaged communities have been enduring from the police force for generations. The lying that goes on by police in a courtroom to apparently feed a prison industrial complex is the only reason. The system is set up for these police to lie regularly.
With impunity.
And there's nothing that can happen? Is there anything that we can do in this case?
I'm really at a loss. Like, suppose there's a potential that they might do an internal investigation, but I doubt it. Officers lie on the stand every single day just to make their quotas. And so this is just a pattern of this larger systemic issue. And I will file a civil suit in federal court. But what's going to happen to him? Probably nothing.
This is something that we would love to change in the system. We want justice to be something real that happens in a courtroom. And we want the right to peacefully protest and to not be as violated as you were in so many ways. Michael Primo, we didn't even get to talk about exactly how much they picked the wrong activists. Primo, you were there on day one of Occupy Sandy, and you do so much good work in this world and in this movement. We'll come back and talk to you again is all I can say.
Great.
Mention the one project that I know is really near and dear to your heart that you're working on right now.
One project that's really important and it relates to this video evidence is called Sandy Storyline. And you can check out the website at sandystoryline.com. And it's an effort to be, it's a participatory storytelling project that allows anybody to tell the story of the impact of the storm as well as our process of rebuilding. Because it's only us who can tell our story. So this is a participatory platform that invites people to share that story.
And I'll feed right in that it's WBAI that gives voice to these stories. You do not get to hear these stories anywhere else on the dial. So listeners, do what you can and realize that you are hearing these stories here and nowhere else. Thank you, Michael Primo.
Thank you.
Thank you to our engineer, Michael G. Haskins, and our technical producer, Reggie Johnson. Listeners, call this number and donate to the Transmitter Fund. 516-620-3602. Listeners, go to the website, WBAI.org, and click that button to donate. We need your help now. It is up to you, listeners. You can find out here on this station how to take various actions in this world. Today, we really need you to take the action of giving this station the money it needs to continue. The Transmitter Fund, 516-620-3602. Go to the website, WBAI.org, and give anything you can. Thank you.